Stand, please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please.
Good morning. Mr. Smith, whenever you're ready.
Your Honors, I guess I would like to begin by just sort of focusing on what I think is under review here. The trial court, in denying Mr. Danso safety valve, did so for very specific reasons. He found that Mr. Danso had failed to make complete and truthful disclosures about the offense of conviction, not about other offenses that might be related to the offense of conviction through, you know, the same course of conduct or a common scheme or plan, but had failed to make truthful and complete disclosures only about the offense of conviction. And he found that the disclosures were incomplete and not truthful for four very specific reasons. There's been talk about other reasons why the court might have been able to deny Mr. Danso eligibility for the safety valve, but the court only found four specific reasons for denying Mr. Danso the safety valve, and I think the focus should be on those, whether the court's findings and on those four factors were proper or not. The four factors that he found, of course, were that Mr. Danso had initially lied about knowing another supplier of heroin. In his initial debriefing, he had said that he didn't know another supplier, though later in the debriefing, he changed the story and admitted that he did know another supplier, someone that he had received a sample from, apparently prior to the transaction involving Mr. Touré. He also found that Mr. Danso wasn't eligible for the safety valve because he refused to identify who that other supplier was, the person that he got that other sample from. He also said that Mr. Danso was ineligible for the safety valve because he denied having any other customers for the heroin apart from the confidential witness that he had distributed the heroin from had brokered the deal between Mr. Touré and that confidential witness. And he found that he had also was ineligible for the safety valve because he failed to identify whom Mr. Touré had previously supplied Mr. Danso with a sample of heroin, and Mr. Danso refused to identify to whom he had given that sample.
Am I correct in thinking that if the district court was correct about any one of these four, not just correct, but if the district court correctly determines that there was one element that as to which he never corrected a mistruth, an untruth, or never revealed the truth, then he's not eligible for the safety valve?
Yes, and that may be the case. I mean, I do think to some extent it begs the question, what would he have done if he had made proper findings in regards to, say, three of them and found that they didn't disqualify him for the safety valve, and then he just found properly that only one of those factors applied? I mean, I guess that would be sufficient.
He wouldn't have any discretion, would he, if one of the factors applied?
I think Your Honor's probably right about that. I mean, I would ask Your Honor to consider them in totality, but I do think Your Honor's right about that. I also think that he was wrong on all four factors.
Well, he would have to be for you
right,
to have an argument.
And, you know, I don't think this is about things other than these four factors. There's been talk about the $500, whether Mr. Touré expected to get paid for it or if he remembered what he did with it. That was not why the judge denied Mr. Danso safety valve eligibility.
Now it's also pretty clear, is it not undisputed, that Mr. Danso has the burden of proof by preponderance as to anything which is fairly put into dispute.
He does, and that may be the key. I'm thinking that may be the key issue here. I mean, I'm arguing that the factual findings that the judge made or implicitly made in denying Mr. Danso the safety valve were based on insufficient evidence, and the government seems to take the position that I'm shifting the burden to the government. But I don't think I'm doing that. I understand that Mr. Danso has the burden to prove by preponderant evidence that his disclosures have been truthful and complete. But I still think with for the judge to deny Mr. Danzo the safety valve, he has to do so upon sufficient evidence. And the findings that the two key findings are is that Mr. Danzo failed to disclose who he had given the sample that he had received from Mr. Touré. He had received a sample from Mr. Touré, but he never did use that sample in connection with the drug deal at issue. So the assumption is he must have used that sample to give to some other potential customer.
He had to either have given it or still possess it, right?
He might have.
Sold it or possessed it.
He might have, or he might have possessed it. The judge.
Or used it, I suppose. That's a fourth possibility.
That's a point. And again, the judge didn't find that he failed to explain what he had done with the sample. The judge specifically found that he had failed to disclose to whom he had given the sample. And that's implicitly based upon a factual finding that he had given the sample to someone. And there's simply no evidence that he gave the sample to anyone. I mean, we're all just sort of assuming that he must have given it to someone.
That seems like something where the defendant could have corrected the record incredibly easily. I lost it. It was stolen from me. I used it. Any of those things. And absent those, I think sale would be highly probable.
I understand what Your Honor's saying.
It's undisputed that there was a sample. I think he has the burden of saying of showing by a preponderance, answering the question what happened to the sample.
Right. He very well may have, but again, the judge only found that it's not that he didn't say what he had done with the sample, and he could have said that, maybe I kept the sample or something like that, but the judge found that he just didn't, the judge assumed that he must have given the sample to someone and therefore denied him safety valve eligibility because he refused to identify to whom he had given that sample.
If he gave it to someone, he should have identified, correct?
I think I have to go
and
there,
if he
yes.
didn't give it to someone, then it would have been an obvious and easy matter to say, no one. The answer is no one. I didn't give it to anyone.
I mean, again, it's possible. I mean, the problem with this, of course, is the disclosures are made during the debriefing, and then the judge makes his comments at sentencing. I mean, Mr. Danzo may not have known where all this was going. The issue may not have been focused on that at the debriefing. I mean, all we have is the filings that the various parties submitted. But again, I understand what Your Honor is saying. I mean, if the judge had found that Mr. Danzo had failed to explain what he had done with the sample and denied him safety valve eligibility for that, I think I'd be on a lot less secure ground than I am now. But that's not what the judge found. The judge found that he failed to disclose to whom he had given the sample. Perhaps on resentencing, that's something the judge could address, whether, you know, it would be a different thing if the judge had found that Mr. Danzo just simply failed to explain what he had done with the sample. And perhaps if the hearing had gone, I mean, perhaps that's something that should be addressed upon resentencing. I think that's an appropriate thing. But I think that would be a matter for resentencing, not for upholding the judge's findings here.
Did Danzo in any way put in contention the proposition that the sample was disposed of by some other means than selling or transferring it to a third party?
His attorney made lots of arguments during the hearing that are somewhat hard to understand because we don't know the context. And frankly, he kept reiterating that Mr. Danzo had told them everything he knew about this offense.
Yeah, that's not very helpful.
And it's difficult. And he makes reference to a lot of matters that aren't in the record, so at some point it's somewhat hard to understand what the attorney's arguing. The parties at the time appeared to appreciate what was being said, but looking back on it, I had a difficult time, and I'm sure Your Honors probably did as well, just because we don't know. He makes sort of oblique reference to a lot of stuff that's not in the record. So I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't really answer that question other than... With the sufficiency of the evidence, I mean, with the burden shifting argument, I guess my position what I'm trying to say is that I don't think the court can simply deny. I understand that Mr. Danzo had the burden of proving by preponderant evidence that he had made truthful and complete disclosures, but still, I think that you can't deny someone the safety valve for failing to make disclosures about conduct that's only hypothetically related to the conspiracy or about conduct that only hypothetically exists.
What about the the finding with respect, there were two samples here, as I understand it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the second one, the one that didn't come from Touré, was used in this offense, correct?
Well, that's another point of contention. I say that there's no evidence that it was used, that it was a part of this offense. The only evidence about the sample, interestingly, the confidential witness who was working with the government and who would have received that sample, we don't have any information that there's no representations that he ever indicated, the confidential witness, that he or she ever indicated that she had received a sample. We don't know when the sample was received. Was it received during the life of the conspiracy? Was it received before the conspiracy? I mean, perhaps we have two separate conspiracies going on here. We have the supplier, the unidentified supplier, and then we have Mr. Touré. And if you think that Mr. Danso is the hub of this and that there's a spoke coming from Mr. Touré to Mr. Danso, and there's another spoke coming from the unidentified supplier to Mr. Danso, we still don't have a rim that connects those two spokes, so there's no evidence upon which to conclude that they're part of the same conspiracy, even if they're temporally occurred at the same time. But we don't even know they temporally occurred at the same time. It could be that he got the sample from the unidentified supplier at a time previous to the existence of this conspiracy, and that's the problem. There's simply no evidence to conclude that the sample, and insufficient evidence to conclude that the sample from the unidentified source had anything to do with this particular offense of conviction.
So you're saying the government brief at 17-18 is completely factually wrong in saying that your argument, this argument, ignores the fact, the government says, that appellant used this sample to lure the CW to Touré.
Well, I guess there's... I think it's a fair conclusion that whenever he gave the sample to the confidential witness, he was not attempting to broker a drug sale between Mr. Touré and the confidential witness. Clearly, he was attempting to broker a drug deal between the unidentified supplier and the confidential witness. So the sample itself was never, that would make the most sense. I don't think the sample itself was ever used to facilitate a drug deal between Mr. Touré and the confidential witness. While he was negotiating that drug deal between Mr. Touré and the confidential witness, he made references to this previous sample, and maybe you could say that the comments he made about the sample were part of the conspiracy, but I don't think that makes the sample itself a part of the conspiracy.
Well, I think it's undisputed, right, that he proffered that this is better. The sample is not as good as what I'm going to bring you.
I'm sorry. He did make comments that
Touré's stuff was even better.
The Touré stuff was even better than the sample that he had. Or he actually didn't make those comments to the confidential witness. He made those confident comments to Mr. Touré. They were all together, and Touré asked him, "Did you give him my sample?"
And that's right. And I told him your stuff was even better.
I told him I'd given him another sample. And I told him your stuff was even better,
isn't that using the sample because it became the benchmark above which Touré's stuff was going to be evaluated?
I mean, I suppose
advertised.
But the problem is the words themselves may be encouraging, but that my argument is that doesn't make the actual obtaining the sample from this unidentified source a part of the conspiracy.
Maybe not the obtaining. We can put that aside for a moment. But he uses the sample in furtherance of the conspiracy. Right?
I mean, I guess you could say that, but I think that's kind of that means any time you make comments during the course of conspiracy about other conduct, that automatically brings that conduct into the conspiracy. And I would ask the court not to find that. I think that sort of stretches the conduct covered by the conspiracy. We can conclude that this conduct had occurred before the conspiracy ever began. And if he makes a comment about this conduct during the course of the conspiracy, my argument is that doesn't automatically then make that conduct a part of the conspiracy. Certainly his comments can be viewed as part of the conspiracy.
Well, I guess it doesn't make at least it seems not clear that it makes the supplier of the sample part of the conspiracy.
And that's the disclosure that the judge denied him safety valve for because he failed to identify who that supplier was.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
I thought there were two.
I mean, so you're arguing that in defining the crime, any question about someone that the defendant uses is within the sphere only if that person is a co-conspirator of some sort?
I get. Oh, I mean, if the yes.
Actually, I mean, there are a lot of cases where criminals got to use all kinds of completely innocent people to effectuate the crime successfully, and still, I guess my intuitive reaction would be that their identities are within the concept of the crime itself, even though they're totally innocent.
I understand, and I think in those cases you'll find some evidence that they were even they that there was well I don't know about innocent people, but I'm not aware of cases where someone who's not a part of the conspiracy, you know, he's been required. I mean, you don't have there's not a whole lot of cases out there, what I'm arguing that I could find, but
well, it may relate to actually the government's ability to verify the innocence or not innocence of this third party, right? I got a car from X, and it was only in order to take my kids to the beach. You'd still like to talk with X and find out just what X's view of that relationship.
Certainly, and certainly the government would definitely want to do that. But I mean, the interest here is whether Mr. Danso has made truthful and complete disclosures about the offense of conviction, not about what. I mean, obviously, the government would like to get as much information as they humanly can, but there are certain limits as to what a defendant has to divulge in order to benefit from the safety valve.
To wrap up our prior colloquy, even if I think we agreed that it makes the in our discussion that it makes the sample something that was used in the conspiracy, but you cast doubt on whether that makes the supplier of the sample relevant to this. But then, and for which he was faulted. But then he was also faulted, as we discussed earlier, for refusing to disclose the disposition of the sample. He gave a different answer to that, different
the sample argument. That he received from Mr. Torre.
Yeah, is that the only one? I thought the sample, yes.
Sure.
So he was faulted for not disclosing the supplier of one sample and the disposition of a sample.
And it's confusing because the co-conspirator, Mr. Torre, he got a sample from him, but he didn't give that to the CW.
Right. So the point is that even if only one of those failures the government need prevail on only one of those failures. Right? They're separate.
I think that's probably right. But of course, I argue that the court's ruling was wrong in both regards. Right. Thank you.
May it please the court, John Hill for the United States. I'd like to begin with Judge Ginsburg's point that it only takes one of these findings to find that the district court did not clearly err in denying safety valve eligibility. And I'd like to start with Torre's sample that was given to appellant. There is the only evidence we have as to what happened to that sample comes from the plea proffer, where appellant says that the purpose of the sample was so that he could distribute it to potential customers. That alone tells us that the sample's purpose was to be given to someone else to facilitate this conspiracy. Appellant never comes forward below and says that's not what happened to it. Even now he doesn't come forward and say that's not what happened to it. And so the trial court did not clearly err when, following appellant's own admission in his plea proffer, the court finds that it was given to somebody and he didn't disclose who that person is.
Could you read again what you quoted from the defendant?
Sure. This is from the plea proffer, and it's at page 28 of the appendix. And it says that Torre gave the appellant a sample of heroin so that the appellant could distribute the sample of heroin to potential customers. And so we know that the purpose was to be given to somebody, and the court wanted to know whom, and appellant refused to disclose whom, and that alone is sufficient to deny him safety valve eligibility. That's sample one, and we're done. Then we get to sample two, which is from an undisclosed supplier, And we know that that sample is used in this conspiracy because it's given to the confidential witness. And at the key point in time when this transaction is going down, after Touré has said it's going to be $17,500 for this heroin, and the confidential witness has to make a decision at that point whether to buy it, appellant interjects himself and says, you know that sample that I gave you? Well, you should go with Touré because his stuff is much better than that sample. At that point in time, the appellant has used this undisclosed supplier's sample to further the conspiracy. He's brought it to the core of the conspiracy, and he's got to come forward and disclose what he knows about it, including the supplier. And it's important to note that down below...
Why the supplier?
Because we don't know... I mean, based on that, at this point, we know that the sample is being used in the conspiracy. We know nothing about the supplier, whether he may be a co-conspirator with these men or not. Appellant never says below, and doesn't even say now, that the supplier was not related to the conspiracy. And remember, he bears the burden of proof of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that he's disclosed everything. He never makes the affirmative assertion that it's not related to the conspiracy. He just shifts the burden to the government and says, even though I have this sample, and even though I've used it to facilitate the conspiracy, you've got to prove that I have to disclose more. Well, at the very least, you've got to convince the trial court at that point that somehow it's unrelated, and he wholly fails to do that. And so as a result, he's got to inform the court, at the very least, who the supplier is and the basic information they're about.
Can you imagine any response that would suffice to show that it's unrelated, that the supplier is unrelated to the conspiracy?
Well, let me take a step back. At the point that he brings the sample in, he's got to disclose everything he knows about it. And so I would say no. There's nothing he could say at that point because the sample is now part of the conspiracy. And once you make it part, you've got to disclose what you know about it. Now, more broadly speaking, if we're talking about how can you talk, say that something is not related to the conspiracy, you can take the stand, you can, you know, present what you know, and the trial court, for example, could make credibility findings as to what you're saying, whether it's true or not true. But in this case, we have no evidence at all being presented by the appellant. He's just making conclusory assertions on appeal that it's worth noting were not made below.
So if he said, I found it on the street, you'd have a credibility issue.
You might. If he said, yeah, I've got this thing, I found it on the street.
He said, I stole it from somebody. I don't know who it was. I stole it from some place.
And he takes a stand, presents that. The trial court can evaluate his demeanor on the stand, whether he appears to be telling the truth. Then you have a basis for crediting that testimony. But short of that, which we don't have anything here, there's no way that a trial court could say by a preponderance of the evidence that he's met his burden when he's presented no evidence.
Did the CW give you anything on this?
Your Honor, I don't know what the CW said or didn't say other than what we've provided in our briefs as to the history of that particular sample. But then again, it's not the government's burden to come forward with that.
Well, if you know the things for which you're faulting him, isn't that a bit...
Well, I can say we don't know. I mean, this isn't a situation where we know for sure where that sample came from. We don't know if it came from a co-conspirator or not. And the reason we don't know is because that information resides with appellant. And that's why the burden is on appellant, because he knows everything.
So now you're saying you don't know.
We don't.
A moment ago you said you don't know what the CW may have told the government.
No, I'm sorry. We don't know for sure who the undisclosed supplier is. That's what I'm saying. It may, for all we know, it's a fellow co-conspirator. That's why it's his burden to show that is or is not the case. But so those are two reasons right there, looking at these samples and looking specifically at the way the trial court has worded its findings, either one of which is sufficient to find the trial court did not clearly err. But I think it's also important in this case to take a step back and just understand why we're here at all, because it was not the government's intention to have a fight over the safety valve, and that's evidenced in our plea proffer where we said, so long as you disclose, we understand that you'll be eligible for the safety valve. But what happened in this case is that during the debriefing, appellant came forward and effectively made a mockery of the process by, one, refusing to disclose basic information, and, two, misrepresenting his involvement in the conspiracy. One, he doesn't say anything in addition to his plea proffer. In fact, he actually retreats from it. And that's noteworthy because...
Well, he had to say something in addition in order to retreat from it.
Well, what I mean is that he didn't supplement what he said in the plea proffer. We had to pull him to even get him to admit what he had already admitted in the plea proffer. And that's noteworthy because by his own admission in the plea proffer, it was, quote, not a complete recitation of all that I did or all that I know, but instead it only covered, quote, some of my conduct and some of my knowledge concerning this conspiracy. And so if you're not supplementing what is admittedly insufficient to qualify for the safety valve, you can't be safety valve ineligible right there. And regardless of whether the trial court specifically enunciated that in its ruling or not, this court...
Where is that statement to be found?
This statement is to be found at page 30 of the appendix. And that's the plea proffer, and that's where appellant, which he, you know...
Page 30, defendant's acknowledgement?
That's where he acknowledges that the plea proffer does not consist of everything that he knows about this conspiracy. And what I'm saying is that he never supplements that. And so by definition, he never fully discloses all that he knows. And as this court has recognized, even if the trial court doesn't make a specific finding on that point, so long as there is, quote, easily recognizable support in the record, then this court may consider that in finding that the court did not clearly err.
Isn't that a very odd thing for a defendant to submit as an acknowledgement? That I'm giving you, what I'm giving you is not all that I have?
Well, at that point, I think we have to understand that the purpose of the plea proffer is not the same necessarily as the purpose of the safety valve. The purpose of the plea proffer is to get enough on the record so that the court can be sure that what you're pleading guilty to, you actually committed.
Okay, so this was just as for the Rule 11 type.
This is just for the Rule 11. Once you get to the safety valve, you have a different purpose, which is to disclose everything that you know. Because the safety valve is a benefit.
I don't know if the acknowledgement does you that much good, because it speaks of not everything concerning his own involvement in illegal activity. So that would seem to go way beyond the crime in question.
Well, then it says, as well as the activities of my co-conspirators.
Yeah,
so it's about this conspiracy, I think. So let me see if we can parse the sentence then. It's not a complete recitation of all that I know concerning the activities of some of my co-conspirators.
And he has got to reveal everything he knows, not only about his own activity, but about what he knows about his co-conspirators to be eligible for the safety valve in a conspiracy case. And so that provides yet a third reason.
All right, now that's in the proffer made for Rule 11.
That's right.
And you say there's nothing to supplement that.
He provides nothing to supplement that. In fact, if I could just take you back, he actually tries to wiggle out of what he even acknowledged there. The way that it went down, and this is presented in the government's sentencing memo and was presented to the trial court, he initially says that he had no other supplier of drugs other than Touré. So we start there, and we say, well, did you receive a sample from Touré? He says, yes. We asked, what did you do with it? He specifically answers, I cut it in half, I gave half to the confidential witness, and I lost half. We said, well, that can't be right, and we played in the audio recording where he says that the sample he gave the confidential witness didn't come from Touré. And then he retreats and says, well, yeah, that's right. And we said, so what... You know, what did you do, or whose sample did you give the confidential witness? First time around, oh, I don't remember that. Second time around, I refused to disclose that. And it's the same answer he gave with the customer that he used Touré's sample for. He refused to disclose that. And when appellant refuses to disclose information related to the conspiracy, he is no longer eligible for a benefit from the safety valve. And so for all of these reasons and for the reasons that we have submitted in our brief, we would ask that you find that the trial court did not clearly err in denying safety valve eligibility in this case.
Thank you. I know that Mr. Smith did not have any time left, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
Is that a count of the sequence of events that we just heard complete?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Government counsel's recitation of the events here, the proffer and the no subsequent addition and the playing of the tape, was that all correct?
The playing of the tape is correct. No subsequent addition. Again, I guess to some extent that's correct. I would point out, I mean, again.
Is there any part you want to correct?
Well, the trial court did not deny Mr. Danso the safety valve because he failed to tell all he knew about the conspiracy. Again, that might be a matter for resentencing. Again, the trial court found that he was ineligible for the safety valve for the four specific reasons that we've spent time arguing about. With this acknowledgement, I know I mean, this is boilerplate that's in there just so that, I mean, at some point there has to be a limit. You can always say that a defendant never made everything he knew about the conspiracy. I mean, you can always find some detail. He didn't say the guy had shoes. You know,
well,
I mean,
if he's got the burden, and then this Rule 11 proffer says it's not everything I know about my co-conspirators, then presumably he needs to come forward with something more before he can possibly discharge his burden of showing that he's told all.
But it may be that what he knows is not particularly relevant. I mean, and I know this.
What co-conspirators, right? So that if they're co-conspirators, then they're relevant to the offense of conviction.
If they're co-conspirators, Your Honor, I'm just...
That would also be true of sources who were, for some reason or other, not co-conspirators. Right, I would think.
That they're relevant to the offense of conviction.
Right. But again, I mean, at some point there has to be, you can't just say, I mean, there may be information, but it may not be particularly significant information. It may be of an incredibly trivial nature.
You're not actually making that contention about these four items, are you? Triviality?
No, not about the four items, Your Honor. That they're trivial. Not at all about that. I'm just saying that with this acknowledgement, I mean, there's no way that a defendant can tell you every single thing he knows about his co-conspirators just because there's millions of details, many of which are trivial, and people don't disclose in debriefing because they're so trivial of nature. And you can't then turn around and say, well, he didn't tell us everything he knew about the conspiracy because he overlooked these trivial details. So the government's argument is that because of this, because he acknowledged that there was more about the conspiracy in this acknowledgement for a Rule 11 purposes, which, I mean, this is for the factual proffer, for the Rule 11 colloquy. I mean, it's sort of standard form, even in the government's own proffers. They say this is not a complete recitation of all the facts relevant to the case. It's just enough to get to establish the offense for the purposes of taking the plea. And that's what informs, I believe, this statement. I don't think this statement was meant to be a definitive statement, especially for safety valve purposes. But my point that I was trying to make was that people are always going to have more information of a trivial nature, not all of it trivial, but there's no evidence that any of the information that he was referring to when he signed this acknowledgement was information of any significant sort. That's the point I'm making in a long-winded way. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.